The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the 15th episode of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And let me say Happy New Year. I know it's 10 days. It's way too long to be wishing you all a Happy New Year's, and I hope you had a good holidays. But the last podcast with Jean-Charles Boissette, that ran so long, I didn't really have time to sort of talk on the top end as I like to do for these podcasts and sort of give my thoughts about what's been going on in the world of wine. The interview that you will be listening to in a couple minutes is with Alison Vidug. She is the head somm, wine manager, wine director of the Short Club in downtown Toronto. And the best thing about her was, she's fantastic and some great stories. But we laughed so hard. This is definitely the most I've ever laughed in any interview. You're really going to enjoy it. I wanted to talk about an issue that has sort of been bugging me a little bit, because wine is such a tough thing for anyone in the industry. And listen, I consider myself on the low end on the industry. I am your passionate wine person. I do have, diploma for WSET. I've studied wine, but because I'm not in it every day, I don't consider myself the true hardcore expert. You know, it's like I always feel uncomfortable calling myself a somm, because, I mean, you've heard these interviews with these people who are somms and their level of knowledge and passion and the work that goes into it. I'm like an interloper. I just an enthusiast with a bit of a background, a high-end enthusiast. But there's always a concern about people in the wine industry about they don't want to be snobby and they don't want to tell you what to drink and what not to drink. And I get that. The whole point of this podcast, make wine fun, make it approachable. So I always hate when you see the traditional snobby somms turning their nose up on certain wines or telling you must drink this. And it bugs me because wine is something that can be insecure, makes people insecure, and then you can be easily swayed. I know I was easily swayed when I was younger getting into wine. Just look at the movie Sideways. Because of Sideways, so many people stopped drinking Merlot and then they started drinking a lot more Pinot Noir. And that's a shame. It's a shame because there's tons of damn good Pinot Noir. And I say that, though, because I have to take issue with a specific wine, and it's been brought up a bunch. It's the Apothic Red. It's a California wine. It's a blend. And Eric Asimov, a great writer for the New York Times, did something which I think is a great idea. He's featuring three wines that are much more mass-produced. Usually, he picks wines, wineries, winemakers, areas that may be a little less known or smaller producers, just to try to expand the wine world for his readers. It's a great idea. But I like what he did here. He's like, okay, I'm going to do these mass-produced wines. But I have such a problem with Apothic Red. And when I was passing by in downtown Toronto, I passed by an LCBO that's right below the Royal York Hotel. It's as you're walking towards Union Station. For people not from Toronto, it's Union Station's the big subway station where it's the hub. It's the hub of public transportation. And they had a huge pyramid of Apothic Red wines. And I don't want to be that guy to tell you what to drink or don't drink. If you like it, then it's good wine. Apothic Red has 17 grams of sugar per liter. 17. To put that in perspective, Yellowtail, which gets a bad rap, and sometimes rightfully so, Yellowtail, Australian, Shiraz, has 10. And I just find that much sugar, it distorts what the wine is supposed to be. It does make it junk food wine. And maybe that's not a bad thing. Maybe people listening, they want junk food wine. And I don't want this to come across as if you drink that wine, then your wine taste is inferior or shame on you or you should drink something else. Like, I really don't. So I really struggle with this. But I find that if you are dumping that much sugar, you're not getting a proper expression of what those grapes are supposed to be. And that sugar is an apology because they probably don't, they're not picking from great sites and they don't have the best grapes. And every grape they pick is going into that vat. you know, if you're going to make wine in California for around $15-16, well, you're going to have to cut corners. I'm fine with that. I get it. You know, I understand the economics. Everyone's got to make a living. But there's alternatives out there. And I remember I was at a party and someone wanted to know just the difference between old world or new world, or, you know, and even that, those sort of generalizations are fraught with errors. But old world, you know, Europe, any country where there was a world war fought on, versus new world, everyone else. And then, you know, so I was giving some examples. And then they wanted to know just like what's a really manufactured, like, you know, how can you tell a really manufactured wine? And this was just by chance at this party. There was a bottle of Apothic Red. This is a true story. And I brought over this Barbaresco, Castillo di Nieve. I think I've talked about it in a past one. Going for $24. It's an intro level Barbaresco. It was $3 off, so it was $24.95. I grabbed as many bottles as I could. You know, it's a great entry level Barbaresco. And so I poured a little of that and the Apothic Red. I said, okay. And I told, okay, this one here, there, it's $8 more. And then that's pretty significant. But try them. And they were shocked. You know, one, obviously drier, more, you know, red cherry, sour cherry, some leather, and, you know, just whatever you're going to get fragrance from the Barbaresco. And then up against the Apothic Red, it was just cough syrup. It was disgusting cough syrup. And it just, it didn't taste like wine. What it tasted like was red sugary juice with alcohol. And if you like that, go ahead. I hope what happens is that that's your portal into wine. And eventually you just try other things. And here's the thing. This is nothing against mass-produced California wine. One of my favorites is called Wente. You know, I think I've talked about that. I got to write down everything I talk about. Wente Cabernet Sauvignon. There's tons of it. And I'm just picking this one at a random because it's around the same price point. And it's from Livermore Valley, which is just a little bit east of San Francisco. It is 6 grams of sugar per liter. Six. Seven Falls Cabernet Sauvignon from Washington State, around the same price. It's actually probably a couple bucks more. I think it's around $21. 6 grams a liter. Take a look on spec sheets, LCBO websites, or, you know, you can find this information. If the sugar gets to be that high, I would just try something else. In the Eric Asimov article, he also looked at The Prisoner, which is a Zinfandel blend, 8 grams of sugar a liter. You know, I mean, that's the Wente Cab has got 6. Now, you know, obviously 8 is certainly better than 17. And the other one was a Meiomi, M-E-I-O-M-I, Pinot Noir, California, Pinot Noir. 9 grams of sugar a liter for a Pinot. Kloss & Chase, which you're going to hear from the winemaker in a couple weeks, Keith Tyers. He has 2 grams. 2 versus 9. That stuff matters to me because, again, it masks the terroir. And if you don't like the term terroir, if it seems too, snobby, every grape is supposed to taste the way it's supposed to taste. Varietal typicity. If you order steak, you don't want it to taste like veal. You want it to, if you order tuna, you don't want it to taste like salmon. Everything has a taste. But with something like Apothic wine, I don't feel there is really any taste. I wish it wasn't produced. I wish it wasn't pushed this way. And I hope that doesn't sound too extreme. You know, listen, let me take a little back a little bit. If you want to buy it, great. And if they sell it and if they make money and it helps employ a certain population in certain areas in California, and, you know, through the tentacles, it means that there are more people that get to have jobs because of Apothic. And then maybe it shines a light in certain areas and then more people drink wine and eventually leads them to drinking other stuff. Fantastic. It's just, it doesn't taste like wine to me. And I'm still struggling with this. You can probably tell I'm very hesitant. Because I don't want to tell you what to like or not like. By doing that, then I'm acting like a gatekeeper of what good taste is. And I never want to do that. In fact, I like to smash those ideas. You know, I want to make it more democratic. But there's just... So this wine has to be that bad to me for me to want to talk about it in this way and sort of get this off my chest. You can tweet me, mcaws56. I'm on Instagram. I think Matt Cause or Matthew Cause. I probably should know that off the top of my head. But, you know, if your thoughts on this, on Apothic, if you like it, tell me why. If this seems too snobby, tell me why. If you don't like it, or if you find, you know, other examples of wines have too much sugar in it, or just they don't taste the way they're supposed to, I'd love to get your thoughts, because it's something that, you know, that I've been struggling with. And I'm going to be bringing up more in more of these interviews going forward. At the very least, on the good side, if that's me just bitching and moaning, the positive over the holidays, beyond getting angry at this wine, I went to buy all my champagne for New Year's, and the person who was ringing everything through, I was about to go scot-free. She forgot to charge me for my most expensive, a $70 bottle of champagne, the most expensive one I bought. And I had that moment, and I'd love to get your thoughts, mcaws56 on Twitter. Have you ever done it? Have you left without it and gone, well, you know, she won't get in trouble, it's a big, giant corporation, or would you feel too guilty? And this is not me patting myself on the back, but I actually said, hey, and I think it's because she was new, she was a trainee, or at the very least, she hadn't been there very long, because I didn't see her, and well, what does that say about me? I go to the same LCBO so much, I know who all the staff are. It's kind of like I'm like Norm from Cheers. That's a reference if you're under 35, you're not going to get. But I'd be like, nope, sorry, you forgot to charge me for this. And she was really appreciative. And, you know, have I from time to time snuck by without paying for everything? Yeah. But I always feel guilty. So on this one case, you know, at least I did the right thing. So as I'm sort of pooping on the LCBO, just LCBO know that I did pay full fare, full freight for my sparkling before the holidays. Anyway, that is enough me rambling. Coming up right now, really fun. And we had a great time, a gorgeous place, the Shore Club. Here is my interview with Allison Vidug. Check it out. Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Cause, and usually I screw up names of wines, of wine regions, of grapes. Southern Rhone, I've been massacring it recently, but this is our first guest where now I might screw up your last name. The sommelier at the Shore Club, Allison Vidug, is joining us. How bad did I do?
Not bad at all. It's Vidug.
Vidug. No. You see, we can already tell how nice you are, because I was horrible and you said not bad at all. Allison Vidug. Allison, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast.
My pleasure.
So you are the wine director here at the Shore Club. And for people who don't know, what is the address? I always like to give the place a plug. Where are you guys?
We are at 155 Wellington Street West in Toronto. Some landmarks are the Roy Thompson Hall and the Ritz-Carlton.
You know, I appreciate it. When I came in, so many restaurants, especially, you know, your downtown places, when you walk in, they always have all the wines that they, you know, they always have the wines out for display. And what I appreciated is you didn't just go, okay, there's the Opus 1. There's our one of three bottles of Lafite. Like, you know, you got the Turley Zin and the Ridge Geyserville Zin, the Tempier Bandol, you know, a rosé that isn't, you know, Whispering Angel, you know. I appreciate that you have a little Burrowing Owl, you know, you have a bit of a different a collection of wines. I appreciated that.
Thank you. Thanks for noticing.
Was that you?
It's me. Yeah, I rotate the wines in the display case.
Okay. Because, you know, you can sometimes find, you know, it's like, okay, there's the Camus, there's the cake bread, and there's the Opus 1. Oh, okay, this is, you kind of have an idea of exactly what kind of restaurant it is when you see those.
Exactly. So the Shore Club, I'm really fortunate. I have a lot of autonomy with the wine list. Yep. And I know there's a lot of downtown restaurants that are a little more corporate.
Yep.
So I'm very fortunate to have a free way with the wines. And I like to have things that aren't as predictable. So still classic and comfortable, but not the usual suspects.
And yeah, I mean, you just want, in the end, you just want to mix. Sometimes I want the classic. I want to know that they're there, but every now and then I want to try something a little bit funky, a little bit different. What are we drinking now? You're very nice. You poured a glass of white. What are we drinking?
So a couple reasons we're drinking this Mousquetaire Sèvres Maine. It's the Polaris. I love the wine. I love white wine. unfortunately, white wine isn't consumed as much as I would like it to be here, so I'm just helping the wine program by making sure we're rotating through it quickly enough.
See, we're not drinking it for us. We're doing it because of inventory concerns.
No, it's just a fabulous wine, but most people at the Shore Club are drinking lots of red wine, which is okay too, but I feel they're just missing out on some untapped resources. So the Polaris here is a refreshing, high-acid wine, nice minerality, perfect little afternoon sip, and it's fabulous with seafood, which we serve a ton of.
Oh, yeah. Like This is your stereotypical white wine with oysters.
Yeah.
You know, the same thing as Santerre with foie gras. This is what you have with oysters.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah, like, I'm not a believer in often telling people, like, don't drink that. But if you're ordering oysters and then you're having a Barossa Shiraz, I'm like, stop it. Stop it right now and get a glass of this because you'll appreciate it more. Yeah. All right. I want to talk to you about just your job and your role at the Shore Club, but I'm going to start somewhere else just because of what you said. Why do men drink far more red than white? What is our problem? Because I used to be like that in my 20s.
Okay.
And it wasn't until, you know, early 30s where that changed, especially when I started studying and going for my WSET diploma and, you know, just when I started that journey. Now it's basically 50-50. Why, what's with men? What's with us?
I don't, you know, I think it's just a perception. And I feel when they're out dining with other clients or guests, it's presumed that, red wine's the good wine. In fact, yesterday I had a table and they were flipping through the wine list. And I was just overheard them say, white wine, what's that? And just straight to the cab.
Of course they went straight to the cab. See, here's the thing about stereotypes. They exist for a reason. Now, it's not blanket 100%, but stereotypes come from a base of truth. Now, can I make a guess? And I hate doing generalizations. It was a group of dudes, probably a bunch of guys, I bet some suits, probably Bay Street type, that said no to the white wine and went straight to the Cabernet.
Straight to the cab.
Am I right?
You are very right. It's funny, I think it was Debbie Shing who I first heard this from, but it's the Bay Street pairing, which is just a cab, a big Napa cab, and we often serve lots of seafood towers here, and I'm like,
do not tell me that. Allison, do not tell me that.
I know. I wish. Just have a little Chablis or some champagne first, please.
Yeah, just try it.
Yeah, then have the cab after.
How hard is that for you? Because I know, like, I would go to that table, and I might not yell at them, but I think I'd be passive-aggressive. Like, oh, you know what? No, that's fine. I mean, pairings aren't for everyone. Sometimes you want to have a wine that's completely wrong with the food. Good for you for going different. Like, I think I would be passive-aggressively attacking them.
You know what? At the end of the day, it's
what they want.
It's what they want. They're paying the bill, and that's okay. So, but, you know,
you need a restraint, don't you?
You have to read every guest differently, and they're all here for different reasons. So some people want to have an experience. They want to learn. They want to try something new. And then other people come to the Shore Club for familiarity. So things they know. And that's okay, too. So I craft the wine program to be available to everyone's needs. So, you know, if you want an amazing Viognier, I've got it. But if you're going straight to Zin, that's okay, too.
That's okay. Oh, yeah. And listen, I love, you know, Cabernet and a steak. It's great. There's a reason why.
Oh, of course.
But I don't want Cabernet with my seafood tower. By the way, how much Viognier do you sell to Bay Street?
It's like, my white wine collection is like my favorite part of the list.
Yeah. What's your favorite white? What's the bottle or two on your list, either by the glass or by the bottle, that you just really like?
Well, just off the top of my head, that Viognier, I only received a couple cases, but it's the Domaine Barou. It's organic. From the Northern Rhone, and it's lovely. It's rich. It's Layered, I brought a bottle to our wine tasting group Flight Club, and I did a blind flight of Viogniers, and everyone was really, really surprised with that from a bunch of industry palates. It showed really well, and it's not, Viognier is a lower acid grape and sometimes can be a little heavy or flabby, but this one is just rich but lifted too. It's great. So I'm happy to share it with my guests, but if I end up drinking it, that's okay too.
Absolutely. it's funny. I was talking a previous podcast with Carrie Mortimer, who's a LCBO consultant, and she is the same thing. There's certain wines she likes, and she's like, yes, you don't have to buy this. And she almost roots, you know, same thing. There's some wines, hey, if I have to drink it, that's fine.
Yeah.
I remember going to Condru with my girlfriend where she stated, I don't like Viognier. And I'm like, shut up. Just shut. Just shh, don't. Someone might be listening. Yeah. How freeing, how wonderful, but also how terrifying is it when you have complete control over the wine program of such a prestigious place like Shore Club?
Well, I've been at it for 8 years now.
Yeah.
So I'm in my groove. I know the flow of business, but it is always a little terrifying in terms of bringing in a product and will we move through it eventually. The good thing with wine is that most of it only gets better with age.
Yep.
So I'm not too worried. There's some nice old Riesling on the list. And what I do get a little anxious about is ordering levels. I was mentioning before we were online here that we had a party last night and they ran through the 7 cases of cab that I'd ordered for them.
Wow.
So I always get a little anxiety. Did I order enough wine for everybody that's
so
coming?
84 bottles.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of ounces of Cabernet.
Yes. Yeah. So that's what I lose sleep over sometimes. Is there enough wine?
How different are you now versus when you started here? Because you just said 8 years. What would you say is the biggest change, Allison, in you in terms of just running the club?
Running the club. Well, it's my first wine list. I've used to work in wine production and wineries. So, I'm just growing with it and changing, learning through mistakes, too. You know, what works and what doesn't work. But I think my goal is to connect with the staff the most now and get them enthusiastic about wine.
Yeah.
And they really are coming through. We host monthly wine tastings where we all sit down at a table, and usually it's a theme. So a couple weeks ago, we took a little trip to Piedmont and opened up some Moscato d'Asti, Barolo, Dolcetta, Barbera, and had the maps out. Everyone can visualize. We talked about different local pairings, and then we ordered some food off the menu. So everyone has a memory with the wine and the experience, and then I want them to take that to their guests in the dining room or lounge.
It's so important. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's selling the story, and I don't even mean like, oh, selling the story like you're trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the guests, but it's funny. You enjoy wine more when you know the story of it. I think it's just you have more of a connection, like as a consumer. You have more of a connection of what you're drinking when you know where it's from. And just you don't need to know what the acidity levels or what day the grapes were picked, but just if you know a little bit of the story, I think you appreciate the wine more.
For sure. Yeah, it's all about the story, which makes the wine more memorable. And it's one of my the bartenders here, she said, oh, Allison, your stories, I can't wait to come to the tasting, and put a big smile on my face. So I know it's making an impact on the staff here, too.
You mentioned, I'm curious, and if you don't want specific, that's fine, but you were saying about, you know, when you're young, when you started, just mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have a memory of just the biggest mistake you ever made, or just a mistake or something where you're like, damn, I've learned from that?
Oh, running out of Prosecco by the glass.
Yeah.
Just my boss at the time was like, order better.
Yeah.
And now. So, or maybe ordering a wine that's a little too natural here.
Yeah.
I can't get color too far out of the lines, but it was a Barossa Shiraz that I thought was gorgeous. It was really alive. And it was $150 on the list here.
Yep.
And of the 6 bottles I received, 2 of them were returned.
Oh.
I know. And not because they weren't able to, and it's okay. It's okay. I took care of them.
But you figure you gave it a home.
Yeah,
it's the same thing. It's like a rescue dog. You know, it's like a rescue bottle of wine.
Yeah,
but you figure that would work. I mean, for the palate and profile of a lot of the people that come here, mm-hmm. a Barossa Shiraz would work with, you know, a lot of the heartier dishes and a lot of the meat mm-hmm. dishes here.
But this was from a small producer, and it was very hands-off, unfiltered.
Right.
And not as conventional, so
do people get nervous? How nervous do people get when it get, like, because unfiltered just means that it could be a little cloudy. It's not mm-hmm. going to be that bright sheen, which can be easier to sell. Is that often a hindrance, or is that often a barrier for people that might not know as much about wine?
A little bit. So I try to educate the guests if there's something, or pardon me, the guests and the staff, everybody.
Yeah.
Just let them know it's a little less typical, but if they want to go on that adventure, it is a fantastic wine, but to be prepared. And then hopefully if we have a little, you know, disclaimer before opening the bottle, the guests might be like, oh, that's not for me. Or they're like, let's do it and try something new. And that way I don't have too many returns. But again, I've learned to what wines suit our guest palate. And so I can't bring in any orange wine here.
Yeah. and you know what? That's fair. And listen, I like orange wine. It's not my favorite, but I like it. And it's always nice. All right, I'm going all over the place. How difficult is it for you to sometimes restrain yourself? Because I imagine if you could have complete carte blanche and ownership said, we don't care about profit. We want it purely the expression of Allison.
Mm.
You know, how different would, like, just, you must be fighting that sometimes with certain wines you'd like to bring on, even though, you know, economically it wouldn't make sense.
Right. I'm pretty lucky that I can bring in small quantities. I love six packs.
Yeah.
So it makes the list look really full and diverse. If it was just a carte blanche, there would be a lot less Cabernet on the list. But that's what our guests
want. That's
what
your guests want. Yeah. Absolutely. What's your funkiest wine here? What's the one you're like, okay, this is going to be sold to a very particular person.
Yeah. That's a toughie.
Maybe the old Rieslings?
Yeah. on that note, I do have the Pearl Morset, the Sputnik Riesling on there.
So good.
Yeah, a little reductive, but
good.
But none of them have come back. And Pearl Morset wines, the Chardonnay does so well here. And they were so kind to me. I needed more of the 2014 Madeline Cabernet Franc.
Yep.
And they were all out, but they pulled some from their library for me. So
what?
I'm well stocked.
Do you have any right now?
I do.
We got to talk afterwards. I'm going to buy a couple of those bottles.
So good.
Pearl Morset. Okay, listen, everyone listening, don't go to Pearl Morset. They stink. Avoid them. Like, I remember when I discovered Pearl Morset, their Cab Franc, I'm like, this is so good.
It's so good.
And then soon, like 6 months, a year later, everyone's writing about it and drinking. I'm like, damn. How hard is it to sell Ontario?
It's a mixed crowd here. So we have a lot of tourists in the summer, and some people are just like, I want to try a Canadian wine. I want a Canadian Pinot or Canadian Chardonnay.
Yeah.
And I have a selection of those. I love Canadian wine.
Yeah.
I've worked in many Canadian wine regions. And we do grow really great grapes here. We make delicious wine. So unfortunately, there are still some people who are like, oh, Canadian, why would I? And they're missing out. So.
Who's harder to sell? And by the way, eventually, I have all these questions written. I want to know your wine origin story. I've got quotes from you. I got all this stuff. But no looking. Who is it harder to sell a bottle of Prince Edward County Chardonnay to? Someone from Toronto or someone from New York?
Someone from Toronto. Yeah.
Isn't that just, it's
isn't that a shame?
It is. It really is a shame. And people need to know. It's just, I was in the county last week. Mm. I was interviewing the winemaker from Clausen Chase and from Long Dog. Of course, by the time this interview is aired, it's probably been a couple weeks. And those wines are so good. And yeah, it's like selling the CFL to Torontonians. Selling Ontario wine to people from Ontario should not be as hard as it is. It's a weird prejudice that we have, which I wish could be just knocked away.
I know. It's such a shame because the culture in British Columbia is the exact opposite. They're consuming their domestic wine. Like we can't get it any in Ontario because they have so much love for their homegrown grapes. It's such a paradox. I don't really know.
I was going to ask, why do you think that is? Because I have no idea. Why? My only theory, and actually I can take this to sports for a second,
okay,
is that Torontonians do not like the CFL. The attendance is horrible. Mm-hmm. They love, you know, the American version. Mm-hmm. And then listen, the NFL has better players because they get paid more. It's very simple. So then they view the CFL as inferior. Now listen, Cab Franc from Ontario, from Promerset's fantastic. Yes, it's better from parts of Right Bank Bordeaux, but the Pearl Merced is still really good and often cheaper. But I think maybe that's it. Maybe there's some sort of snobby thing. I don't know what it is. Why Ontario is it so much harder than it is in BC? It's strange.
It's strange. But to be honest, I do see it shifting a little bit. Like as I mentioned earlier, some guests are coming in here and saying, oh, we've got the Pearl Merced, or oh, I want to try something Canadian. I always like to have a mix of Canadian representation on by the glass too.
Yeah.
Currently pouring Westcott Vineyards Pinot Noir from Niagara, and we are serving Malavoir Moira Rosé.
Yep.
And the other red I wanted to mention was the Mission Hill Terroir Series Syrah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny, because if someone will say, I have a Pinot by the glass, and then they'll say, oh, great, right now we're serving a local wine down the road, and it's really beautiful. They're like, oh, no. And I'm like,
I was drinking the Organized Crime Pinot Noir, you know, that's like near St. Catharines, and you know, it was drinking great. It was fantastic. Yeah, at some point I'm going to come in here. I want to drink your old Rieslings.
Yes.
Because I'm a member of the National Club.
Oh, great.
And they have all these old Rieslings that the last winemaker or the last wine buyer purchased. No one drank them. It's like my private collection. Yeah. Like 15-year-old, really good Moselle Rheingau Riesling for like $50.
Wow.
Because you're a member there.
Right.
You pay duty.
Yeah,
they don't. They whatever they paid for it at the time is what they charge you for it.
Wow.
It is like my own private cellar. All right, this quote from Allison.
Oh, goodness.
I do remember being 14 on a wine tour in the Barossa Valley with my family.
Yeah.
The tasting room attendant told us she would have to stop pouring for my parents if they didn't stop sharing their wine with me.
It's true.
So your parents were allowing you to drink high alcohol wine. Your parents were pouring you wine at 14 in a tasting room in Australia.
Yes.
Please take us to that scene.
It's, wow. All right. Well, it's a distant memory now. But we were touring and my mom kept passing her tasting glass to me so I could have a taste as well.
That's awesome.
So my parents weren't expansive like wine drinkers, but I was lucky to try the wines, but it was illegal.
How much influence did your parents have for you in your career?
Like I said, wine was always around, but they're, you know, just happy drinking the, you know, usual suspects, nothing too expensive.
Yeah.
But yeah, so wine was always there. They were very supportive of my career. So they learned through me now, and we still drink really nice wine. They're supportive.
Did you have, and I ask every guest this, do you have, what's your wine origin story?
Wine origin.
And there, for some, it was drinking a bottle of Burgundy from the bottle. Actually, Burgundy seems to be a common theme for a lot of them. And if you don't, that's fine. But like, do you have a moment where you're like, okay, this is what I need to know more about all this?
Yeah. So I started with ISG when I was 19 in Lake Louise. And I was like, oh, I'll take this wine course and I have something to do in the winter.
Yeah.
And it didn't quite click. And I think the moment was actually in the Germany lesson when I was continuing ISG level 2. And Peter Bodnarod was our teacher here in Toronto. And I was just kind of like tasting the wine. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. It's clicking. Like, it's a sense of place.
Yeah.
And then that really, really hit home for me when I lived on Salt Spring Island in 2006. And I ran the tasting bar there and the bed and breakfast.
Yes, they're serving wine with local cheese and oysters to guests. It was, quote unquote, it was magical.
It was. The miroir and terroir.
Yeah. By the way, you know what I love? Okay, you are a stereotype. And I don't mean this in a bad way, because we all are. And I'm going to tell you why. What was one of the things that turned you? It was the German class. Let me guess. It was the Riesling, wasn't it?
It was Riesling.
It's always the Riesling. I'm trying to explain this so much to a lot of people that are listening to this are just people that are into wine enthusiasts. You know, some are the hardcores, but I always try to explain, drink more Riesling. Trust me, there's been a lot of guests who've been yelling into the microphone you're holding right now, drink more Riesling.
Yeah, more of Riesling, please. But you know, it's funny, I love Riesling and I collect it at home, but I'm guilty myself of not drinking enough Riesling. I tend to, I drink a lot of Chardonnay.
Chardonnay is my favorite. If I'm going to do my rankings, and again, I come from a sports background, so I rank everything. Chardonnay is my favorite white. Riesling is number two. It's a close number two, but still, Chardonnay is my second one. And I always love when someone does the, any ABC, anything with Chardonnay. I'm like, okay, I guess no Montrachet for you. Like, I always find I'll pour you some Chablis. I'll even pour you one with some oak in it, but it's so integrated and just people... The non-Chardonnay thing baffles my mind because it comes in every form.
Oh, it's so strange. And so my wine list here is set up by grape variety because that's how most guests look for their wine. So every once in a while, I'll have somebody be like, oh, I want a Chablis. And I'm like, oh, happy to point you to the selection available here in the Chardonnay category. And they're like, I don't want a Chardonnay. I'm like, well, you're in for a rude awakening.
you're in for a wonderful awakening.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Yeah.
And by the way, at some point, I want to talk to you about when you were on Global News.
Okay, yeah.
Because you did something on Global News that amazed me that you did. But we'll get to it. No looking at my script. as a somm, when you're working the floor, what's your technique or just when it comes to trying to make wine less intimidating? Because the theme, the through line through almost every one of my podcasts is wine is fun. We need to make it more approachable for people. We need to make it less intimidating. Because to me, it's always a shame when, you know, people get intimidated by it. What's your approach or technique?
Okay. I had to think about that. I'm going to see myself on the floor.
Or what would you tell other somms? Because, you're not, I shouldn't ask you like that because you're not on the floor all the time.
Right.
You know, you're the director of the whole wine list here. So you have a different set of, you know, different set of responsibilities. What would be your message to somms out there?
Just to have a warm and welcoming demeanor about yourself and not to be too pretentious or rhyming off words and names that are hard for people to grasp in their mind.
Yeah.
But just make it kind of meet them halfway in a language and an embracing way that they're comfortable and they're not going to be a little nervous to spend X amount of dollars on a bottle. But just, you know, giving confidence to the guests in their wine decisions.
Yeah, and I think one thing I like there what you said is just be careful of the adjectives and verbs that you use. There's a time and place to say slightly bruised yellow apple, and there's a time to say it's rich, little bit of butter, and it's warm and full-bodied, and damn, it actually tastes really... You could eat this with red meat. Mm. You know, there's a time and place. And I think that's definitely part of it, is that it's our jobs in whatever walk of life we are in wine to explain to people that... this is a damn good glass, and you're going to love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I also teach at George Brown, and I just wrapped up my last class last night. It was the exam night. I've been teaching Wines 1 there for 3 years, and my students, I love them. They're always like, do you teach any other wine classes? I'm like, thank you, but no, I'm full-time at the Shore Club. But some of my students, it's nice. I've heard from other instructors or students that I see in the hallways once they're taking another course, and they're like, thanks for making it so much fun.
Yeah.
And that's like your podcast theme is all about. It's wine. It's supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
I remember another incident when I was working in Niagara. I did the winemaking and viticulture program there. And I used to get a lot of anxiety about making additions to tanks because you're like, oh, that's 10,000 liters of 1 year worth of work. Like, don't mess it up.
Yeah. Really?
But one of our instructors, he was at Cave Springs, and he said, guys, it's just wine. Mm-hmm. It's not heart surgery.
Yeah. But still, okay, take me down. What did you do with the tank?
I was working Harvest 2007 at Coyote's Run Winery.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I thought you worked, did Harvest in Okanagan.
I did too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, okay. But sorry. So Coyote Run, continue.
Yeah. So, and you would just have to add bentonite to stabilize the wines.
Yep.
Just adding nutrients, yeast, but yeah, just making sure it was integrated well. And oh, the sound of liquid in a winery is just heart attack central. You're like, did I leave that valve open?
Oh my god, I'd be so stressed.
It's stressful.
Oh yeah, it's interesting. In a minute, I'm gonna get to your appearance, your global news appearance,
we'll get there.
I find when wineries or somms are talking about wine where we use no chemicals, it's purely organic, and it's biodynamic, and it's all these things, and it's vegan, and that's all lovely. Mm-hmm. But at the same point, even in the DRC, mm-hmm. you know, from time to time, sulfates, things are used.
Yeah.
What do you say to people that, you know, they want no chemicals in their wine? I think, what do you mm-hmm. say to people that say that?
That's okay. I don't think people have a full understanding, and because I know this myself, before I had been involved with wine production, it was just like really eye opening, all of the steps, the chemistry, the biology, all of those things. But, they're not, most of the additions to wine aren't literally in the wine. They've passed through the wine.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Here at the Shore Club, just because my preference, I do like a lot of untouched wines.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I had a table the other day, and they were drinking some
Grand Cru. And by the way, explain to people what untouched wine means.
I mean, just less manipulated, mm-hmm. right? So if we're talking about a product that's for mass consumption and production, it is formulated at the winery to be a certain way, so it tastes the same way. Just talking big brands from, you know,
Jaylor.
Yeah,
sure. Jaylor, which again is fine. Mm-hmm. You know, you need every style of wine, and mm-hmm. you need one where you know what you're going to get. Though,
yeah,
there's another side that we could argue against that, but nonetheless, if you want to buy wine that is varietally correct ish, mm-hmm. And it's under $20.
You got to do things. But like this wine we're drinking right now, I really respect the agency that it comes from and the collection that they have and what they're. It's kind of the truth in wine, right? So the less that the wine is molded in the winery, the clearer the flavors are of the vintage, the varietal, the place, and it's the stories in the glass right there. So yeah.
What's the hardest day? What does it look and feel like when you're doing Harvest? Whether it's in Ontario or Okanagan, what was the hardest day for you, Allison?
Oh goodness. So I kind of stumbled into this job. I was working at a little winery in West Kelowna called Kalala, and they needed someone to work production, and I just straight out of Niagara College became the winemaker that season. The grapes just kept coming, and I processed the 10,000 tons on a Wilms press, and I'd drive there at like 5:30, 6 in the morning, and I'd work till 10 at night and get there in the dark and leave in the dark. And it was exhausting but fun.
Yeah.
And we used to ferment in milk containers, so those really long stainless steel containers.
Yeah.
And I was doing punch downs early one morning, and the lid fell on my head.
Oh no.
And I was just like, that's it. I gotta go. I just need to go home and sleep, because I just broke down crying. And they're like, okay, maybe you go home. So I just slept for a day, and then went back to work.
Okay, hold on. Okay, so this out of Niagara College.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, you were the winemaker at a winery in West Kelowna.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Good for you. Fantastic for you. Were you nervous? Was there insecurity? Like, did you show up first day and go, what the hell? Or were you like, no, this is exactly what I should be doing. I mean, what was, because, man, that's a lot of, because when you get into wine, you have so much respect for it. Sometimes almost too much respect that you might get even more nervous because you don't want to hurt this process.
Right. Well, here's the story. So,
yeah, I want to hear it.
Niagara College ran until the middle of summer 2008, and then I had a wedding early September. My goal was to go out to the Okanagan because I just wanted to know about Canadian wine, and I hadn't spent any time out there in the Okanagan specifically. So I went with a friend. We took our time zigzagging across Canada, and I was like, you know what, if I don't go now, I have to wait a whole other year. But it's a strange time to be going because it's end of tourism season, so no one's going to be hiring for front of house positions. And everyone's already hired their harvest help, so I'm like, oh well, I'm just gonna roll with it.
So see what happens.
We picked up some hitchhikers.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And we were just driving around one day, my girlfriend and I, and we picked up these very hippie couple. We drove them down to Oliver.
Hold on, wait. So that's why you did it, because it was a couple and they were hippie.
Yeah, they were.
If it was one like very large man with a stoic look on his face and like, does he have a machete? You might not have picked him up. But
No, I
picked up hitchhikers once and it was the same thing. It was two girls and a guy, and they also were all in tie dye. I'm like, you feel safe to me.
Yeah, I think it's gonna be fine.
So you went to Oliver, which is a great growing region, southern BC. I think north of Osoyoos.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so we're in the South Okanagan, and we're chatting with them, and they were out there picking fruit. And actually, that's a lot of hippie couples or people or anybody. They go out to the Okanagan to do this, and they just stay in their tents and pick fruit and make some money. So literally, my girlfriend and I picked fruit one day for Greta Ranch. We were picking Chardonnay. That was hard work. And then I had made friends at a small winery called Rollingdale in West Kelowna, and I really enjoyed hanging out with those guys, and they had a really fun winery. And then their friend Carnell at Kalala needed harvest help. So I was just there helping, and it just kind of happened.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's great. And by the way, for people, and I'm going to do a sweeping generalization. Southern Ontario, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Riesling, Cab Franc. Mm-hmm. I think we do great stuff there.
Those are the top four.
Yeah.
And Gamay.
Yeah. I was just at 13th Street today. Oh, I bought two bottles of their 15 Gamay. And I think when I think of BC, I was shocked how good the quality of the Syrah was, but the Merlot, the Bordeaux blends, especially in Okanagan, and if you go down to Osoyoos, you're in desert, and also the Chardonnay, like BC, their Bordeaux blends, their Syrah's killing it.
Yeah.
I never found a Pinot Noir I loved, but I found plenty of Syrah and Bordeaux blends that I thought were killer.
Well, what's interesting about the Okanagan and to keep in mind when you're drinking wines from out there, it is a very long wine region.
Yeah.
So I think with time, they'll start to identify different sections of it, because in the north you're getting beautiful aromatic varietals, Kerner, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Riesling, even Gewürztraminer. It's very Alsace-like,
Grey Monk's got a lot of good aromatic whites, absolutely.
But as you get down to the south there, like almost right on the border with the U.S., it is hot. You can fry an egg on the hood of your car in the summer. It is so hot. So the Syrah is fantastic, and Merlot is becoming the signature red grape of the Okanagan. It's consistently good.
So
great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I agree. At this time of year, you'll see often on your local news channel, they're going to bring in the wine expert to do wine pairings and all that sort of stuff. And so doing my research on it, you were doing a food pairing with wine on Global News for the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
You explained malolactic fermentation on Global News when you had a 4-minute hit. You cocky SOB. That was hilarious. I was like, damn, is she actually going to do it? And you did a great job, but I couldn't believe you did that.
I'm going to have to rewatch that. I don't even remember.
Did you black out? You're like, what am I doing?
I've been going on Global for a few years now, and yeah, it happens so fast. Yeah. I'm just like, whoa, what happened? It is a blackout moment, but that was so much fun. And I liked my collection there, too. I had to throw in the Canadian Chardonnay from Stratus as their Tollgate series.
I saw that.
Yeah.
By the way, for people listening, especially for just people getting into wine, the term malolactic fermentation, mm-hmm. you're going to hear it a lot. And it sounds really confusing. Mm-hmm. But explain to people, especially people that like Chardonnay, exactly what malo is and what it does.
Okay, so it's a conversion of acids that happens after the alcoholic fermentation. And it's changing that sharp green apple, Granny Smith kind of acidity that we like in our refreshing crisp white wines, and it's a softer, gentler acidity that has a creamy sensation, and diacetyl is produced during malolactic fermentation, which gives a little bit of a caramel butterscotch flavor to the wines too. And so typically white wines that are barrel aged, like Chardonnay, will go through malolactic fermentation if they're made in that style. And other times, not all Chardonnays are put through malolactic fermentation, so they maintain that refreshing side to the Chardonnay grape. That's why Chardonnay is such a chameleon.
Yeah.
It can be anything.
It can be anything, and it can be grown almost anywhere.
Yeah.
So it'll get looked down upon. It's like, oh, well, Pinot needs exactly perfect conditions for it. While Chardonnay's like, hey, I'm here to party.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
You want me to be hot? You want me to be cold?
Yeah.
Am I on the mountain? Am I on the valley floor? Don't worry. We'll party. And you had a Turley. You had a Turley.
Yeah, I took
down.
The Turley.
It's funny. I watch some of these TV hits. I'm like, damn, you're some cheap-ass wines. And then I see you. You're opening the Turley, which is a California sin. And I mean, it is delicious.
It's so good. Yeah. So I've kept it on the list here. I used to serve it by the glass because we have a Coravin program. It's not currently, but in the future maybe. But I love Zin, especially this time of year. And I think we were serving it maybe with some braised short ribs on the show.
That'd be great.
So yeah, it's magic. Yeah. So 'tis the season for Zin.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been a lot of fun. I think this is the most I've laughed at any of the the pods I've done so far. Where do you see yourself, and where would you like to see the Shore Club, like in a couple of years down the road? I mean, obviously maintaining a certain level of consistency and excellence and all of that, but is there anything that you would like to see?
I'd like to see the wine culture grow. Our menu here is very familiar. It's a steakhouse, right?
Yep.
So, but I would like to see a little bit more maybe of the wine community coming here. And I'd like to continue to grow the collection with older vintages and cooler wines. I mean, I do have a budget to always keep in mind.
Yeah, but stupid budget.
Just the diversity of the wine list, and just kind of keeping it growing, keeping it hot, keeping it new, and inviting for people to come enjoy the wines.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for doing this again. The Shore Club, just on Wellington, it's right next to the Ritz, and it's really easy to get to. And this, I mean, it's a gorgeous restaurant. It sort of feels like a steak joint because of the darker colors, but there's still, and the high ceilings, but still plenty of light, and just an interesting looking spot mm-hmm. with a great wine list. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for everyone for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can always get us, it's me. I don't know why I said us, on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Audioboom. Tell your friends, and again, rate the podcast. Unless you didn't like it, then you don't need to rate it. Just go do whatever you want to do. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.